on February 9th. Representative Shiragi and I are in the room, and I can't tell if Representative Sponholz is still online. Okay. Today we have three bill hearings, first hearings on House Bill 289, House Bill 295, House Bill 276. Actually, 276 is under bills previously heard and scheduled. So first up, House Bill 289, Alaska Marijuana Industry Task Force by Representative Hopkins and staff Joe Hardenbrook. Representatives McCarty and Kaufman are also present. Representative Hopkins and Mr. Hardenbrook, please proceed. And Representative Snyder is present as well, all with by 432.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields and members of the committee. For the record, Representative Greyer Hopkins is my name. Representing Northwest Fairbanks, Esther, Goldstream, Steel Creek, Farmers Loop, Birch Hill, and Downtown Fox. With me today is my trusty staffer, Joe Hardenbrook. Thank you today for hearing House Bill 289. This bill would establish the Alaska Marijuana Industry Task Force to take a holistic look at our state's growing marijuana industry, analyze its strengths and weaknesses, and propose a package of reforms. These non-binding reforms would be submitted to the Marijuana Control Board, the governor, and the legislature for consideration and possible action. This legislation does not create a permanent task force, nor does it create a permanent state-funded position. Rather, this task force would complete its work between the time the bill is passed, hopefully this legislature, and over the 2022 legislative interim, and deliver its final report at the beginning of next session, disbanding itself at the end of the year and giving us that report. This bill does not require the expenditure of any unrestricted general funds. Instead, the cost of this task force would be borne by the program receipts generated by Alaskan marijuana industry. While I am a firm believer in free markets and the inevitable sorting out of winners and losers, Alaska's marijuana industry is ours, and we as elected officials can and should set the rules for the thousands of Alaskans who seem fit to invest their hard-earned dollars into this market, as well as their time and energy. We can and should ensure that the rules that we put forward to govern our various industries are fair and reasonable and offer those Alaskans who pursue a career or business investment in Alaska can work hard and achieve that success while playing by the rules. We can and should ensure that the local governments continue to play a vital role in authorizing, monitoring, and gaining revenue from this industry as well. As our uniquely Alaskan-owned, operated, and supported marijuana industry continues to evolve, the work of this task force can help place the industry on firmer economic footing and ensure that those Alaskans who've entered into this industry can compete on a level playing field. Additionally, this task force carves out a role for Alaska's local governments to ensure that the local control of this industry, endorsed by Alaska's voters as they passed the initiative in 2014, is strengthened and continued. We would have the opportunity after the initiative passed in 2014, almost a decade later, to be able to reform this growing and vital industry. At this point, I'll turn to Mr. Hardenbrook to give the committee a walk through the bill.
Thank you, Chair Fields, members of the committee. For the record, Joe Hardenbrook from the Office of Representative Hopkins. Why is this legislation necessary? In 2014, Alaska voters legalized recreational marijuana. Since that time, thousands of Alaskans have sought to participate in this new industry as business owners, workers, investors, consumers, and more. This industry is a uniquely Alaskan one. State law requires that license holders be Alaska residents, resulting in Alaska marijuana market owned and operated by Alaskans who then sell their products, owned and operated by Alaskans selling their products grown, tested, processed, and purchased here in the last frontier. The industry which has emerged from the passage of the voter initiative in 2014 is supported by Alaskans across the state, but it is facing some challenges. Many business owners are struggling to comply with the letter and the spirit of the law. And several factors, including taxation, licensing, and enforcement, continue to challenge the industry. Recent reporting by the Anchorage Daily News, which is included in your bill packet, shows ongoing frustration amongst the Alaskan entrepreneurs who've invested time, resources, and energy in this new market. Our flat wholesale tax model makes each cultivator's crops an expensive roll of the dice and can result in entire harvests being discarded for fear of not generating sufficient revenue to pay state taxes or insufficient overhead to cover the cost of facilities, salaries, and utilities. Unlimited licenses have resulted in a high number of retail outlets, and tying licenses to specific properties and locations have resulted in business owners being forced to close shop when rents increase or when their buildings are sold. Make no mistake, there are solutions to these problems, but finding and defining these solutions will involve give and take amongst the members of the industry, state regulators, and local governments. In order to pursue a strategy that strengthens our Alaska businesses, protects local control, and places our industry on a firmer economic footing, House Bill 289 proposes that this task force reviews the issue, develops ideas for industry reform, utilizes state resources to model how those changes would affect businesses, local governments, and state tax revenue. A simplistic one-size-fits-all solution to this complex issue will most likely result in additional challenges to the industry and may cause unforeseen circumstances which compound problems instead of rectifying them. As we've repeatedly heard from representatives of all the different businesses and resource development activities in Alaska, fiscal certainty and good data are essential components of any successful business enterprise. So how will this task force operate? The selection process for the 12 members of the task force has been crafted to ensure representation, expertise, and geographic diversity. The task force will be chaired by the chair of the Marijuana Control Board. The two state agencies most closely involved in Alaska's marijuana industry, the Departments of Commerce and Revenue, will be represented by their commissioners or those commissioners' designees. Because so many of these questions are economic in nature, we've reserved a seat for an economist from the University of Alaska. Because the voter initiative carved out specific roles and rights for local governments, we've included three municipal government representatives with a requirement that those officials come from different judicial districts and represent the breadth of Alaska's local governments, cities, and boroughs. Because those most affected by a decision should have a role in making that decision, we've reserved three seats, 25% of the task force's membership, for representatives of the Alaska marijuana industry. Like the local government seats, these task force members must hail from different judicial districts and represent the breadth of the industry, cultivators, processors, and retailers. Finally, there are two legislative seats, in the hopes that the input and advice of legislators can help craft a final product with a greater chance of enactment. As Rep. Hopkins mentioned, this task force is not a permanent creation. Rather, it must meet four times over this legislative interim, conduct their work, craft their proposals, model their data, and submit their findings to the executive and legislative branches for consideration and potential action. This legislation does not create a new permanent position, but rather relies on a temporary position to assist the task force in crafting its final product. The findings of this task force are, first and foremost, non-binding, and are not limited to suggestions for legislative fixes. Suggestions may include statutory, regulatory, and administrative changes. Additionally, I think it is fitting and worth noting that the cost of these efforts will be borne by program receipts from Alaska's marijuana industry. That's correct. The cost of this task force will be paid for by the hundreds of thousands of Alaskans who invested in and patronized Alaska's marijuana industry. Chair Fields, at this point, with your permission, I'll run through a quick sectional analysis of the bill. This is for version B. Section 1, subsection A, creates the Alaska Marijuana Industry Task Force and describes its purpose. Subsection B details membership of the task force and those responsible for nominating members to serve. Subsections C and D detail how vacancies on the task force will be filled and that members are unpaid, but they are eligible for travel expense reimbursement and per diem. Subsection E details duties of the task force, deadlines, and instructions for submitting recommendations. Subsection F terminates the task force upon the convening of the 33rd Alaska Legislature. And Section 2 contains an immediate effective date upon passage and enactment. Chair Fields, I'd also like to note for the committee that we have Nick Miller, Chair of the Marijuana Control Board, and Glenn Klinkhart, Director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, online for questions about the bill and its fiscal note, as well as invited testimony from representatives of Alaska's marijuana industry. Thank you, and with that, I will conclude my presentation.
Thank you. Representative Nelson was here at 4:34. Not seeing questions at this time, I want to proceed to invited testimony. My goal is to finish the first hearing on this bill by 4:50, so we can hear the next two bills on the agenda. We're just a little backed up because of finance subcommittees. So if the invited testifiers can attempt to get through their testimony in 2 minutes, I'd appreciate it. First up is Jana Weldson. Ms.
Chair Fields, I apologize. If it would be possible, Lacey Wilcox would need to testify first. If
that's sure. Ms. Wilcox, come on up.
Good afternoon. Hi, Chair Fields. Thank you, committee. My name is Lacey Wilcox. I serve as the elected president of the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association. Currently, it is the only statewide industry association similar to CHAR, if you're kind of thinking of our sister industry. I'm going to go ahead and read my letter of support because it's been approved by my board of directors, and I'm here for questions if you have any. So obviously, we support the bill. The excise tax on Alaska marijuana cultivation has a static price floor for marijuana and marijuana products. This static price floor is creating instability in our industry and resulting in an inequitable taxation burden imposed on the cannabis industry. So, for example, the excise tax of $800 a pound of cannabis flower in Alaska is similar to the total wholesale price in states like Oregon. So you can buy a pound for $800, which is our tax. The problem is evident, the impacts are negative, and a solution is needed. The solution will only be found if we have a comprehensive task force with the right tools and the right people to dig in and find a solution to better protect the industry and consumers. We are hopeful that with the passage of this legislation, we will be able to see robust, smart, and data-driven conversation occur between industry regulators and tax experts, as well as municipal stakeholders and the legislature. We are grateful to be named in the bill regarding the selection of qualified industry representatives. We understand that while we do not represent the entire industry, the AMI is the only statewide industry trade group at this time. So we therefore will take the spirit and intent of this bill very seriously in selecting those three industry seats. The bright goal for the AMIA is to help identify a sustainable, enforceable, and above all else, fair tax structure. This tax structure should allow for growth, not hardship, and should provide a path to compliance without subjective review or punitive action whenever possible. We are grateful to be considered a valuable industry, job provider, taxpayer, and general business community asset to Alaska. We see a bright future and are hopeful that this task force will come to fruition and we can move forward together. It is no secret that we're struggling. So I hope that this is not a surprise for all of you, and I would appreciate your support. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And through the Chair, Ms. Wilcox, how much does AMIA cover through the cannabis out here in Alaska, cannabis businesses out in Alaska?
Well, we're right now in the middle of a membership drive, so I couldn't really tell you what our percentage of representation is, but I think there's about 500 licensees. We probably represent close to 100 of them on our normal given post-membership drive season. The pandemic has certainly slowed down the outreach to get members. But what I tell people all the time is that I don't just represent our members, I represent everybody.
Paul. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, one of the things that I'm concerned about is, the three members you would be recommending to the board and putting up, two of which would be your own members, and that's understandable. But then the third would be someone from outside your organization. I just have a fear that if that, dues paying members, we're going to put you up because you're technically not a part of our organization, or someone that supports us, we'll keep you out while putting the other 400 of the business owners or license holders kind of out of it. Do you have anything that you're going to be holding yourself to, or can you alleviate some of those concerns?
Yeah, Representative Nelson, through the chair, I would like to build, with the passage of the task force bill, a process for applications open to any licensee. Obviously, I think it's a way to encourage membership, be able to advertise this as something that we can do for people who have not considered joining. There are certainly a lot of businesses and Alaskans who are not joiners. They just don't like to be a part of an organization, and I still talk to those people. They're pretty important parts of our industry. They're quiet. They're maybe rural. And I find them very valuable. So I'm going to be looking really hard to honor the spirit of the task force. And it isn't just my members who have the most to say. In fact, some of the smartest people are the quietest people, and I'd like to find them. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, Representative Draghi.
Thank you, Chair Field. So my question is, of your membership, can you talk to me about kind of the split or makeup between cultivation, manufacturing, and retail? And then second question, just in the interest of time, you know, how well unified do you think the views on where taxes should go with respect to the industry, leading to, are we getting this balance right? Kind of my same concern. Thank you.
Certainly. Representative Shaggy through the chair. Right now, there are, I'm going to give you some numbers. There are 240 roughly growers, and that could be a small license or a large license. There are 145 retail licenses operating, and there are about 50 manufacturing licenses. So you're going to hear a lot about market saturation, and you're going to hear a lot about potential license caps and other solutions that are going to help us find market equilibrium. I'm a pretty big proponent of fixing the things that are broken before going that big extreme measure of instituting a license cap similar to alcohol. And the answer to your question is there is not consensus or agreement. If you were to ask only cultivators, they're going to agree that the tax should be shifted, shifted away from them. If you ask only retailers, they're going to suggest that the tax stay exactly where it is. Perhaps it gets reduced. Manufacturers who are kind of in the middle or vertically integrated, which is considered a very smart business model, they're going to be kind of indifferent because they're protected by their own business model. There is not consensus, and that's what we'd like to try and find. And I only think that we can do that if we can model it out.
Very quick follow-up. Actually, never mind. Okay, thank you.
Representative Cardi.
Thank you. To the chair, the intent of the bill before us, regarding line 30 and 29 and 30 of page 2, that of compensation, is it anticipated that these task force meetings are going to be live or can they be virtual to reduce that expense?
Representative McCarty through the chair, I was asked earlier if it would be okay if we met virtually, and of course the AMI would be happy to do that. We've become really accustomed to that, but I would let the bill sponsor's office answer that question.
Go ahead, Representative, or Mr. Hardenberg.
Thank you, Chair Fields, through the chair. Representative McCarty, we broached this exact subject with the director, Glenn Klinkhart, of the Alcohol Marijuana Control Board here in Alaska, and he said that through the course of the pandemic, they've been meeting by and large virtually, and they felt that that would be something that they could continue doing with this task force. Currently, the fiscal note does include money to cover the cost of travel and lodging for folks. But if the legislature did choose to make the task force meet virtually or put that intent in, it would be a substantial cost savings on the total fiscal note of the task force.
Just to follow up with that, we have several task forces that are meeting now for different reasons, and it seems that they're all meeting by virtual. That would be my recommendation.
Representative Coffin.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm not sure who could best answer this, but it's the first thing I wonder is why does there have to be a bill for this? What other industries get together and discuss how to improve their industries. Why does there have to be a bill? Thanks.
Representative Kaufman through the chair. I think that one of the, and for the record, Joe Hardenberg from the Office of Representative Hopkins. I think that one of the key reasons for government involvement in this task force is specifically the data that is collected by the state as the enforcer of the laws through the Commerce Department, as well as the collection of revenues through the Revenue Department. And by having those two aspects of state government involved and mandated to participate here, the industry, as well as local governments and state governments, can model how changes to taxation would impact revenue flows to the state, to the industry, and to the local governments. And so by having the state as a participant in that, we can access the data, we can do that modeling, and we can make those sound fiscal decisions that protect the state's bottom line, the municipality's bottom lines, and also put the industry on firmer economic footing.
Let's go ahead, Representative Kaufman and then Representative Shragi, and then I want to finish invited testimony and move on to the next bill just to be respectful of other representatives and upcoming testifiers.
Thank you. Through the chair. It sounds like those are simply deliverables that could could just be pulled down, that doesn't need involvement as much as just produce the data. And so I'm not sure if you'd need kind of the government partnership piece of that more. You just need the deliverables. Give us the data. And I think that should be available.
Representative Kaufman, through the chair, I'll speak to that briefly and then punch it over to Ms. Wilcox, if that's all right. Any industry would prefer fiscal certainty and good data when it comes to making business decisions. And when you're talking about adjusting the levers of taxation, as well as an industry that's entirely located within Alaska and is also producing revenue for local governments, changing those levers without good data to inform how those decisions will impact the industry, state government, and local government, perhaps could make the situation worse as opposed to solving the problem. We've heard from members of the industry that there is some frustration that the ability to model how changes to the taxation scheme, because that modeling has been difficult to develop and the data has been difficult to procure, that perhaps setting up a task force to move this forward is the best way to ensure that those participants who have the data and the folks who have the expertise on the industry, as well as the folks who have the expertise on how the industry works at the local level, getting them all together in a room to talk about this and formulate a solution is the best, most responsible way forward.
Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to ask about the DGF funds being used. So my understanding was that there's a couple of different places the marijuana taxes, the revenues from those taxes could go. Which of those designated funds would be utilized for this?
Representative Shragi, through the chair, I think that that question would best be posed to Director Klinkhart of the Alcohol Marijuana Control Office, who developed the fiscal note and who is online to take questions.
Go ahead, Mr. Klinkhart.
Thank you to all the representatives through the chair. Could you please repeat the question specifically? I'm taking notes. I'm actually looking at the fiscal note, trying to see how best I can answer that for you.
Yeah, thank you. My question was just, it's my understanding that the revenues from the marijuana taxes that we have go to a couple of different places. Which of those designated funds are being utilized in this fiscal note?
Through the chair, I'm looking here. These are the sources are going to be the TGF from the program funds specifically. And so that's going to be coming out of the receipts that we received.
I'll follow up for more information later. Thank you.
Sounds good. Let's finish this invited testimony. Next up in invited testimony is Jana Welgzen. Ms. Welgzen, please proceed.
Thank you very much, Chair Fields, and members of the committee. I'll be brief because I said we're running past our time. I own JW Council, and my firm represents hundreds of marijuana licenses in the state of Alaska. We're by far the most comprehensive law firm representing marijuana businesses in the state. I really, really appreciate this bill coming forward, and I really appreciate the members' questions. It shows interest, and it shows that you guys are thinking about our industry and thinking about how to move it forward and make it sustainable for Alaska. We need to start discussing these issues in a way that is meaningful and not just a few industry folks gathering together, because federal legalization is on the horizon and we can see it. And when it gets here, if we're not prepared, our industry will be demolished. And to be prepared, we need to be strong enough to stand on our own or relevant enough to be bought out. And we cannot do that with a static price floor that for some cultivators results in a 50% taxation, but for another cultivator who's grown the same pound, the same strain, just sells it for more, maybe $3,000 a pound, that tax for them will only be around 27%. That's a regressive tax structure, and it's not fair, and it's not sustainable. This would allow our industry to work with local governments, work with the experts in the Department of Revenue, and develop a system that is going to make the state more money in the long run, because the industry will survive if we do this right and if we put the hard work in now. So that's why we need this bill. It's really important to our industry, and I hope it's important to this committee, and I really think it's going to be a benefit for Alaska moving forward for years and years. If we do nothing, we will face those consequences, and it will be detrimental.
Thank you, Ms. Welks. And next up in invited testimony is Nicholas Miller. Mr. Miller, you can proceed.
Good afternoon, and through the chair, thank you. My name is Nick Miller. Again, I'll keep it brief as well. I am a licensee and currently the director or the chair of the Marijuana Control Board. I fully support this bill, and I hope we can get your support. There are has been lots of discussions about the taxes and ways to improve commerce in the state through statutory changes and regulatory changes, but we do need that partnership from an economist and the holders of the data so we can actually make some good decisions. You know, making decisions based on the information we have now is not in the interest of anybody in the state. So keeping it short, I wholeheartedly support this bill, and I hope you will too. All right, thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Miller. The amendment deadline for this bill is Sunday, February 13th at 3 p.m. I apologize for the abbreviated nature of the hearing. Don't hesitate to reach out to Representative Sponholes and I about potential amendments that you may be offering, and Representative Hopkins as well. Next up, first hearing on House Bill 295, Dentist Special License Radiologic Equipment, from Representative Ortiz and his staff, Abigail Sweetman. Thank you, Representative Ortiz, for being here to describe the bill.
Good afternoon. For the record, I am Representative Dan Ortiz, and I represent District 36, Southern Southeast Alaska. And with me today is my newest staffer to my office, Ms. Abby Sweetman, and this will be her first bill presentation. So treat her kindly, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you, Co-Chairs Fields, Sponholes, and the committee for hearing House Bill 295. House Bill 295 works to solve two problems facing Alaskan dentists and helps them to do their jobs safely, efficiently, and honestly. Firstly, this bill transfers the oversight of dental radiological equipment from the Alaska Board of Dental Examiners to the Department of Health and Human Services. Alaskan dentists have had great difficulty finding private radiological inspectors for their X-ray equipment, and as DHSS already oversees medical radiological equipment and employs inspectors, this is a way to ensure that dental equipment is being inspected at the right intervals by the people qualified to do the job. Secondly, Mr. Co-Chair, this bill establishes truth in advertising for dental specialists. Alaska currently doesn't have a legal definition of dental specialists, which means that a dentist can advertise as an endodontist specialist without having an endodontist training. I, Mr. Co-Chair, certainly would want the dentist performing my root canal to know what they're doing, and I think everyone in this room would want that as well. Alaskans seeking dental specialists should be confident that their dentist has the specialized training to give them the best care possible, and HB 295 does just that. These concerns were brought to us by dentists who recognized obstacles in doing the best job they can for their patients, and these concerns are worth considering by passing HB 295. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Ortiz.
All right. Co-Chair Fields, committee, for the record, I'm Abigail Sweetman, and I have the great fortune of being staff to Rev Ortiz. I'll just lead you through a quick sectional analysis, and then we can move on to some invited testimony. So the first section is conforming language. The second section adds a new section to Chapter 1, Section 65, and requires the Board of Dental Examiners to establish and collect fees on behalf of the Department of Health and Social Services for the inspection of dental radiological equipment. Section 3 adds three new sections to Title 8, Chapter 36, the first of which establishes that a dentist may not advertise using the term specialist, the name of a specialty, or other phrases that suggest they are a specialist unless they have a specialist license as established. The second new section establishes that in order to qualify for a specialist license, a person must, hold a dental license issued by the Board of Dental Examiners, and meet the qualifications of a specialist as established by the board. In addition, this also establishes the qualifications for a specialist license, in which the board shall consider the standards of a nationally recognized certifying entity approved by the board. In addition, this establishes that a dental specialist can only claim to be a specialist in the specialty they hold a license in. The third new section establishes that the board has the authority to suspend or revoke a specialist license. Section 4 adds a new section to Title 44, Chapter 29, Section 20, and requires DHSS to establish standards of registration, use, record keeping, and inspection of dental radiological equipment in compliance with federal law. Sections 5 and 6 are conforming language, and Section 7 repeals a law that is no longer relevant under Section 4 of this bill. Section 8 allows the Board of Dental Examiners, DCCED, and DHSSS to adopt any necessary regulations in line with this act. Section 9 allows the departments and board to immediately begin setting regulations, and Section 10 sets a delayed effective date to allow this legislation to be set up with an effective date of July 1st, 2023.
Thank you, Ms. Sweetman. Not seeing any questions, let's go to invited testimony. I believe first up is Dr. Dave Logan, Executive Director of the Alaska Dental Society. Thanks, Mr. Logan, for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'd like to thank Representative Ortiz for bringing this bill forward and doing such an excellent job of describing the need for it there. And also like to congratulate Abby on hitting it out of the park in her first plate appearance. After their descriptions of the bill, I really don't have a lot to add there. I'll talk a little briefly over the x-ray aspect. I believe Dr. Nielsen from the board is on, who can speak to the need for the specialty license there. As Representative Ortiz noted, there really isn't an avenue right now for dentists to get the necessary inspections of their x-ray equipment. They have to use state-certified inspectors. Those inspectors don't exist, unfortunately. There is simply are none that are certified that dentists can use. And this has been going on for a number of years. We've had a couple of false starts at legislation. We just haven't really seen the traction yet. And this year, we're coming up to a deadline. We're going to have dentists, they're going to start to fall out of compliance at year's end. So without some action of some sort, dentists are going to face an unenviable situation at year's end that their x-ray machines will no longer be in compliance with the necessary inspections. And consequently, they'll either have to use machines that are no longer compliant or not be able to use their machines at all, neither of which is a great option. In addition, these machines do need to be inspected periodically, and those inspections can't be done anymore, unfortunately, which is not helping things from a public service or a public health standpoint. We really would like to get those machines inspected. And with that, I would be glad to answer any questions the committee would have.
Okay, it sounds like there's interest in hearing the rest of the invited testimony and then doing questions. Dr. Nielsen, would you like to give your invited testimony?
Yeah, thank you, Chairman Fields, for inviting me today. I'm the current chair of the Alaska Board of Dental Examiners, and I'd like to thank Representative Ortiz for bringing this bill forward, and I agree with Dr. Logan. He did a great job describing it. I'll focus a little bit on Section 3, and I'll just have a little bit of testimony there, and then we'll take questions on both Sections 2 and 3, whoever has questions. So, basically, the Dental Practice Act saw a repeal of specialty license categories in 2012 for reasons that I'm not really aware of. I wasn't on the board then. The Dental Board has since shied away from investigating false or misleading advertising complaints that tend to crop up. And in order for the board to address this, we need specialty license categories that can hold up under legal scrutiny. The Dental Board requires the ability to help reduce public confusion over deceptive or false advertising brought by dentists using the term specialist or specializing in to an area of dentistry that is professionally recognized to require significantly more training than they have received. Typically, an accredited postgraduate specialty program demands an extra 2 years minimum of focused training beyond dental school. And one of the things that hasn't been mentioned really is that the dental board has had to deny a few license applications to specialists trying to come work in Alaska. And that's just because we didn't have a way to approve their application. And that's because without having a license type that's limited to the specialty area of dentistry that they've been practicing in for years, or that they have a specific training in, we've really had to deny licenses to dentists who have graduated from accredited specialty program. So if we can limit the scope of practice of the specific branch of dentistry covered by the specialty license, it will open the doors a little wider to more qualified specialists to come here. That's really all I had to say to describe the reason why we're looking for this. If there's any questions about that, about the specialty recognition or x-rays, we're here for questions. So,
thanks, Dr. Nielsen. And in addition to Dr. Nielsen, Dr. Logan, and Bill's sponsor, Director Chambers is in the room. The Board of Dental Examiners is within DCCED, Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. In addition, online, we have Jamie Parker, Chief of the Public Health Labs at DHSS, Irene Casares, Radiological Health Physicist at DHSS, and Renee Gayhart, Director of Healthcare Services with DHSS. So thanks to all the experts for being available for questions. I think Representative McCarty had a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, I've got several questions. So first one is, to anyone who could answer this, is currently I'm hearing that there's not someone to inspect for the machines used in dentistry. And if this, well, first, I guess the question is, are there dentists under investigation because they cannot comply with this? And if so, then also, what is it projected for this to be implemented? If it's not implemented fast enough, does it mean that every dentist can have to shut down and we just have to brush our teeth more?
It looks like Director Chambers and Dr. Nielsen. Let's start with Director Chambers. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sarah Chambers. I'm the Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. We currently are not investigating these potential out-of-compliance dentists because there is no program with which to comply. So we don't want to put them in sort of a catch-22. The plan would be, if this bill passes, would be to assist Health and Social Services in any way to get this up and running quickly and then move toward compliance rather than an enforcement right out of the gate. So we would definitely want to make sure dentists were aware of how to comply and if there was a program that allowed compliance.
Dr. Nielsen, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, thanks. That's a good question, Representative McCarty, through the chair. I agree with what Director Chambers says in that there's just realistically not a process in place for one dental examiner to figure out which devices of the 2,400 or so that are out there are out of compliance. The dentists have had nobody qualified to do their inspections for years. And so we all just want to get caught up and get this program going again. And DHSS are the people to do it. So I agree with what Director Chambers said.
You had additional questions, please proceed.
Additional questions, follow up, thank you. So through the chair, since the dentistry has not been able to find individuals to do the inspections, how viable is DHSS able to find people to do the inspections?
Mr. Chairman, this is Sarah Chambers. Through the chair, Representative McCarty, and certainly Health and Social Services reps can speak to this too, but it would be a different model. The board has typically utilized a private sector model that would rely on a supply of people who are out performing anyway this type of service for other healthcare devices and haven't been able to identify someone in the last several years who is qualified to do that or willing to do that. The Health and Social Services model, which is, I believe, reflected in both of our fiscal notes, would be to employ someone
who would be able to do this. So that would be a fee that we would collect a fee from the dentist to pay for the service and RSA that over to Health and Social Services to pay for the person on staff. That would ensure that there was someone available to perform these inspections.
Go ahead.
Okay, with the follow-up. So I appreciate that. Thank you. And kindly speaking, saying this, so is this kind of like kicking the can from one department to another to kind of, this is now you deal with this problem? And truly, before, the dentists were paying out of there for the inspections, but they could not even find anybody. So it sounds like there's not even an inspector, you know, a lot of them in the state to do this. What is the grace given to the dentist if it's going to take a while and already we have a workforce problem, but to be able to do this for the future? What is the grace period also planned in this?
Go ahead, Ms. Chambers, and maybe we should ask that staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Representative McCarty, we are all in support of moving this program. It would require radiological physicists to perform these inspections, and we don't happen to specialize in that. So we are looking to our partner, sister agency, to leverage their expertise to do something that's currently under dental board statute as an assist. And we often work that way with Department of Labor, Environmental Conservation, for efficiency measures as well as for expertise. So we don't have to reinvent the wheel, as you will. The grace period would really extend to the length of time that it would take for this program to be up and running. We are not in the business of enforcing impossible to comply with laws. And so we would be working closely with Health and Social Services to make sure, again, that the program is functional and fully staffed and available, and to clearly communicate a rollout of that inspection series to the dentists who are involved. So compliance rather than enforcement.
Jamie Parker with Hess, is there anything you would like to add to that?
Sure. To Representative McCarthy through the chair, for the record, I'm Dr. Jamie Parker. I'm the chief of State Public Health Lab that houses this radiological health program. We currently have a single radiological health physicist that works and inspects and registers over 1,000 non-dental devices every year. In order for this to really be successful, we will need to hire another radiological health physicist. And as you mentioned, this is not easy to come by, but it's not impossible. And I think if we want to move forward with this type of program, we're going to have to do our best to identify that person. But it will require DHSS to hire additional personnel to take on this additional capacity.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. So the effective date on this is July 1st, 2023. Just projecting, do you think that that's a doable time frame that it goes live to, or are we going to see investigations put on dentists to, in case things are challenging to be able to do the assessments, exams?
Representative McCarty through the chair. We've been in communication with DHSS, and this is an effective date that seems like it works the best for most people, and like that's a realistic start date. The original start date was March 1st, 2023, I believe, and July is a more reasonable date. So,
okay, thank you,
Mr. Chairman. If I could,
go ahead.
Just reinforce through the chair to Representative McCarty. We would not be investigating if the program was not able to be complied with. I just wanted to be really, really clear that we would not be initiating investigations for people who couldn't comply with a program that was not fully up and running.
Thanks. Representative Nelson had a question.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Through the chair to Director Chambers, Dr. Logan was saying that we're kind of heading up towards a time period, you know, where it's getting past 6 years. If we were to go over that, you know, what would kind of be the response from you? And, you know, you said you're not going to enforce impossible laws. So is it just kind of up in the air and now we don't have to deal with it? Or, you know, are we going to keep flying in people from Lower 48 to come out and help? Or if this doesn't get through enough in time, what's that future look like?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Nelson. I think that's
a great question that we're going to have to work really closely with the industry to determine, because the first step would be for dentists to not utilize equipment that wasn't properly inspected or wasn't where they were not complying with the laws that are attainable, which means that if you have a radiological piece of radiological equipment that hasn't been inspected within that 6 years, you really need to make a professional call as to whether you want to run the risk of some kind of damage, you know, happening to your staff or to your patients. That's not, we are not going to be seeking out investigations because they didn't comply with a date that's on the books. That's a little bit different angle than professionals making a call as to whether they feel comfortable using equipment that was out of compliance, if they feel that that was safe, if they have information that would lead them to believe it was safe to use on their patients. And I think a lot of that's just going to be linking arms and doing our best to plow forward with Health and Social Services if this bill passes and gives them the tools to do that, and communicating with dentists, because neither one is an outcome that anybody wants.
Paul, go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair to Director Chambers, if this were to pass, you know, going back a little bit, some of the fees that are going to be put onto it, would that be enough to cover, you know, the $500,000 fiscal note that this bill has attached to it? Or is it going to be, you know, if it costs only $100 and one time per every 6 years, you know, what's the fiscal responsibility for this?
Through the chair, Representative Nelson, the intent, in as the fiscal notes indicate, is that this would be completely receipt supported. So one way to look at it is that this is a program that's currently theoretically on the books, and that we should have been collecting these fees, or dentists should have been paying the private contractor these fees to do it. But because there hasn't been that market the last several years, this is, they've really kind of saved that money, I guess, over the period of time, because they haven't had to spend it. So they are aware, we've discussed with the board on the record, that we will have to, because we're going to a model of a state employee, or Health and Social Services would be doing that, that we are going to analyze fees as we do through our annual fee analysis to set all of the fees for any licensing program, and determine what that particular sector's group payment will be for that annual, that inspection for that year. Again, it's a every 6 year, if that's the final model, every 6 years you'd be paying that amount. So it wouldn't be an annual amount to every dentist, but we do need to recoup that cost, which again had been paid through the private sector, now through the public sector.
Go ahead.
And just following up, we, you know, if we establish this new position, we're hearing in some of our finance subcommittees that they're still having struggles with recruiting people for, you know, public jobs compared to private jobs that pay a lot better. So if we were to pass this and we have a position open like this, it might go past the deadline. So where's that relationship at of, you know, we have someone on the books, but we just can't hire anyone because no one's going to accept that position?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, that might be a better question for the writer of the Health and Social Services fiscal note.
Okay.
Do Ms. Cazares or Ms. Gayhart have additional input on that?
This is Irene Cazares.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, please proceed if you wish to respond to Representative Nelson's question. I got you.
Okay. Thank you. This is Irene Cazares. I'm with the Department of State Health Services. I'm the radiological health physicist. And through the chair, to the senator who asked the question, the situation of the inspections would be, once the program is attainable and a person is hired, and there are people in Alaska now that have approached me about the position and asked me about the salary and what the job would require, they have asked what the duties are, what they would have to do. They are willing to take this job, this position currently, and get the program in alignment to do the inspections, get the dentist in compliance, get the equipment looked at. It's just the fact of who, when, where, and how does this, you know, get started. And that is our situation at the present time.
Go ahead, Representative Nelson.
So you'd be confident in saying that within a few months, if this were to pass, that we'd be able to hire someone and have them out already inspecting the machines?
Yes, through the chair, yes. That would be a yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Coffin.
Thank you. Through the chair, and I'm not sure who would be best to answer this, so I'll throw it out there. In the area of specialization, as folks, you know, general dentistry and then the various specialties, how do we manage the risks to prevent someone who specializes from being locked out of something that they're qualified to do because of categorization? So, I don't know, if I'm a very expensive specialty dentist of some type, and in the process of doing what I need to do something more mundane that's down, it's a general dentistry thing. Do we have any risk of that? That's just one thing I wonder about as we do this. Do we have good definitions that have enough latitude or overlap?
I want to turn to Dr. Logan and Dr. Nielsen and see if you would like to respond to that, and then we can go to the agencies. Mr. Nielsen, you're still muted. I think you clicked on it, but it is.
Representative Kaufman. Yeah, through the chair. That's a good question. There are certain specialties that have probably a little more cross training, I would say, with certain general dentistry procedures than others. And so you have to look at each specialty individually to see what they routinely do. I would say that it's a little bit of a gray area, but I wouldn't suspect that, say, a endodontist that wanted to put a little filling in an access opening they did or something like that would be a problem. So it would be kind of on a case-by-case basis. And I can't give you the exact scope of practice for each specialty down to the letter. But it'll be on a case-by-case basis. It's actually just more appropriate to allow a specialist to work in their specialty area and just keep it at that, because I can't list. There's really, I don't even know of a list of a procedure by procedure. So it's going to be case by case.
Dr. Logan, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just say, in general, most specialists are not interested in performing general dentistry. There are some specialists, like Dr. Nielsen mentioned, a root canal specialist and endodontist, may do routinely throw a filling in on top of an access hole. A periodontist, for instance, a gum specialist, they would have absolutely no interest in putting a filling in. That's just simply not what they deal with. They're in a completely different piece of the anatomy there. So I don't think there's too much danger that we're going to see specialists wanting to do general dentistry. So I don't think we're taking something away from them.
Before we go on, I just wanted to ask Ms. Chambers or Dr. Parker, or I guess anyone else online, do you have anything else to add to this discussion?
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, these will be some of the things that the board will need to work through in regulation. And I would say that it would typically fall to the education and training that the person is presenting. And so we would certainly not intentionally prevent someone from practicing something they were qualified to do and that they would want to do. And so if they wished to pursue both pathways, then there is a method in the law to do that. And the board will just need to narrow that down through the regulatory process.
Follow.
Thank you.
Can I speak to that too?
Sure. Go ahead, Dr. Nielsen.
Thank you. I agree with that. And really the intent of this is more the other way around, and that is to allow someone that's had a lot of training in a specialty area to come to Alaska, even though they haven't done general dentistry, quote unquote, for a long time. And like Dr. Logan said, they're not wanting to really do that. So So the intent of this is to open things up for specialists that are highly trained in their area. And so we're not going to focus a lot of time on not allowing a specialist to, say, put a little filling in once in a while if they feel qualified to do it.
Go ahead.
Thanks. Through the chair, just a comment. I think the only thing I would want to be careful of is where we create this catch-22 situation where there's this little piece of work and somebody is afraid to do it for fear. And it's something that they're confident to do, but somehow it's not for the regs. And the devil, I think, is in those details. But otherwise, I think in general, everything I'm seeing is going in a good direction. I just wanted to
thanks, Representative Kaufman. I want to go back to Representative Gardy.
Thank you, through the chair. I concur with that of Representative Kaufman of just it being micromanaged to a point, but I'm not necessarily hearing that from our guests saying that. What I'm trying to understand here, and I'm looking at the statute briefly here, is like the problem that we're in that's being addressed in the bill is because we didn't have some provision for the specialist dentist, but we do have specialists in dentistry in the state already. So I'm a bit confused of where the problem is at if we already have specialists, but we can't recognize other specialists that have tried to get into the state.
Dr. Logan, do you want to take that one?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. There certainly are specialists in the state, about 150 of them overall. They're in the various specialties that are represented within the state. But by not having a specialty license, they can't differentiate themselves from somebody else as a specialist, or they can, but the reverse, unfortunately, is also true. A general dentist can list themselves as a specialist, even though they don't have the requisite training, and the board is powerless to prevent them from doing that because they don't have the statutory authority with a specialty license.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions on this bill for the bill sponsor or the various experts? Okay. Seeing none, thanks everyone for being here to answer questions. The amendment deadline for this bill is Sunday, February 13th at 3 p.m. Last item that we have today, sorry to make you wait earlier, Representative Ortiz. The last item we have today is House Bill 276, Psychologist Licensing and Practice. This is a committee bill, and my coworker Grace Kubitz will present it. This is the first hearing in Labor and Commerce. Please proceed, Ms. Kubitz.
Of course, for the record, Grace Kubitz, and I think the easiest way may be to pull up the PowerPoint and we'll have Mr. Rugwinden online to go through it. And
then okay, I can sounds good.
Do a sectional after, or I think the PowerPoint may cover enough.
Are we ready?
Grace is pulling up the PowerPoint now, and okay. It's almost there. And I think if you just say when to advance through the slides, she can do that, and it should work fine. Okay, the PowerPoint's up. Would you like to proceed? And how do you pronounce your last name?
Rugwinden.
Dr. Rugwinden. Okay. Chair. Please proceed, Dr. Rugwinden.
Just Mr. Rugwinden. It's okay. Fine.
Okay.
Good afternoon, committee members and Chair Zach Fields. Thank you for allowing me to present to you this afternoon. My name is Marvo Rugwinden. I'm the executive director for the Alaska Psychological Association. I also have with me Dr. Robert Lane, who is a past member of the board and currently a professor of psychology and the director of counseling psychology at Alaska Pacific University. Next slide, please. Alaska Psychological Association, or APA, represents Alaska to the American Psychological Association. And we currently have 135 members in good standing, so 8+ from what you're seeing on the slide. And the membership is primarily made up of psychologists and psychological associates. The difference between the two titles are psychologists have a doctoral degree and psychological associates have a master's degree. And for both of those to hold their titles, they must be licensed. Next slide, please. The association's mission is to promote the advancement, communication, and application of psychological science and knowledge to improve the lives of all Alaskans. Next, please. The association's delegation to the 2017 annual American Psychological Association Leadership Conference learned about a model licensing act that APA had introduced, which is a roadmap of policies that help guide state licensing boards in drafting rules and regulations. When the delegation returned to Alaska, they created a committee to explore what changes could and should be made through a series of workshops that were open to ACLA members and the public, and gained enough interest to support and introduce changes for Alaska. Next, please. Currently, the statutes and regulations allow for psychologists and psychological associates to obtain a license or obtain a temporary license, and HB 276 would introduce a middle ground. Next, please. An overview of HB 276 for psychologists and psychological associates would amend how student supervised hours are acquired. This was the core of developing our Model Licensing Act. As you may or may not know, Alaska has two universities with doctoral degrees in psychology, so this became a very, very important point of creating this Model Licensing Act. The other aspects of HB 276 would be the introduction of a part-time license and also the introduction of an inactive license for both psychologists and psychological associates. And in addition, it would better define the practice of who the practice of psychology does not apply to by including contractors and defining tribal health organizations that are licensed in another state. Next, please. So I'm going to go into a few of the details regarding the part-time, regarding the supervised hours. As I mentioned, we have two universities with doctoral degrees and graduating students quickly. So this would follow a national trend that would allow 3,000 hours to be completed before graduation through practicum, internship, or postdoctoral experience. It does not alter the quality or quantity of training. Currently, 17 states allow the resequencing of training hours. It follows a model used by medical schools and allows students to get licensed and enter the workforce sooner to benefit all Alaskans. Next, please. With the introduction of a part-time license, this new classification would allow senior career licensed psychologists and psychological associates approaching their retirement to continue their practice with limited hours and to continue to use their respective titles as licensed providers in writing papers, research, and presenting continuing education. As I mentioned earlier, you need to be licensed in order to call yourself or use the title psychologist or psychological associates. So this part-time license would allow them to do that. And they must be licensed for at least 20 years in order to have this part-time license and engage in no more than 20 hours a week.
Mr. Regenden, what's the logic in an additional part-time license instead of just continuing to carry a regular license?
If you wouldn't mind, I'll allow Dr. Lane to respond to that question.
Great. Dr. Lane, if you're online, perhaps you could explain the benefits of having a part-time license in addition to a regular license.
Yes, to the committee, to the chair. The intent with this, the psychology license statutes in Alaska are both title and practice. And so when we had these work groups, the members got together and talked about what would we like to see happening with our statutes and licensing laws. There was a group of senior psychologists that were interested in trying to be able to hang on to their ability to use the title without having to pay the full fee of the license.
They're exiting out of work, and I'll give you one quick example. It was a colleague who is no longer in private practice, but had treated sex offenders for years in the criminal justice system here. He wrote a book and would like to be able to share the research findings with the psychologist here in Alaska, but he can't really do that unless he's licensed. Because he would be holding himself out as a psychologist, and appropriately so. So it was a way of allowing people that are no longer trying to do private practice still to be able to be psychologists in the community and share their work with others. I think the other piece that I would add to that is that I'll use myself as an example. As I am beginning to age out of the workforce, retirement is here in just another year or so, but I have put an adult career into being a psychologist. And if I don't maintain that license, I can't refer to myself as a psychologist. So there's some discipline or professional identity that kind of goes with it. I think the idea with this, the licenses in Alaska are defined by the number of users, or the amount of the license, is defined by other the number of users. Our license has been as high as $1,400 or $1,500 at one point. It's come back down to some degree or another. But again, the intent, I think, was to be able to get some sort of reduced licensing fee and allow people to hang on to the title and have a very limited scope of practice.
Okay, follow-up. So as I read this new section, it says the board may issue a part-time license, so I guess they might choose not to, and I don't see any parameters about the extent to which the fees might be reduced. Is that your understanding? That would be basically left to the board and, I guess, the department.
Yes, to the chair, I think we were aware that much of what happens in the actual practice of things happens in the development of regulation. And we didn't want to get down into the weeds in an area where we didn't fully know, without the board being involved, the licensing board being involved, and the division being more involved in the development of regulations. So our thinking was, if we could propose the statutes, then regulations would be developed, and then appropriate license holders would have a chance to opine on the regulations.
Okay. Director Chambers, would you like to come up and join Ms. Cubis at the table? Do you have any opinion or concerns about this new part-time license?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Sarah Chambers, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. I understand the intent behind the license. Honestly, we have not had a lot of opportunity to speak with the board or the association about this, but there is really no guarantee that there will be a lower license fee. Really, it's the same amount of regulatory work to approve the credentials in the background and so forth for someone. So right now, a license fee for a renewing psychologist would be $500. So that would have to be ask for a reduced fee for essentially the same amount of regulatory work would really be asking the board to endorse on the record a scheme in which the full-time licensees are subsidizing the regulatory cost of the part-time or inactive licensees, assuming that that workload is the same. It takes the same overhead lights, heat, staff time to evaluate credentials, work through paperwork, and of course there's also investigation costs. So,
right. Thank you. Do you object to being given the authority as long as it's a may, or do you think it's better to just not be given that authority?
Mr. Chair, this is not really a novel concept. Many of our licensing programs give the board the authority to evaluate credentials and determine if someone is qualified, and then, you know, to have the intent to meet this niche market. So it's not unusual, and we certainly wouldn't want to stand in the way, but I think As Mr. Lane or Dr. Lane mentioned, that those conversations haven't happened regarding the cost or the application workload and what the credentials might look like. The devil's in the details, as Representative Kaufman mentioned earlier. So we don't have any objection to it, but there are details that need to be worked out, and I can't guarantee that there would be a lower fee for this type of license.
Okay. Well, thanks for that explanation, and I think Representative McCarty has a question.
Yes, through the chair, I have several questions, and thank you for your explanation from regarding Rep. Fields or Chair Fields. So you said that there's other boards that have something similar, and I want to define similar. Do you have other boards that have a part-time license position?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, I'd want to double-check and make sure that I'm not speaking out of turn regarding the part-time license specifically. We do have many boards that have the inactive licenses or sort of a license light, so to speak, but I'd be happy to get back to the committee on whether a true part-time license exists with other programs.
Okay, follow-up. So through the chair, this follow-up is, if there's a part-time license position, that suggests that the licensee is working part-time, which, let's make it 20 hours, which seems to imply that there has to be verification that the person is not working more than 20 hours, which seems to put a lot more on the division to have to verify, because I would say, boy, if it's cost less, I'm going for my part-time and working under the table. And I'm not saying psychologists are bad people, not at all, because I'm in mental health business too. I appreciate psychologists. But you understand the scenario. And it seems like that would have to put more energy on a part-time person. And what I'm hearing is, just for the privilege of the title, and that same privilege exists for a full-time type thing for $500 every 2 years. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, I think you're hitting an important nuance. That is correct, that there may not be the inactive license might do the same thing to allow someone to continue to use their title without seeing patients. And there is a potential for risk. What we would probably do, again, just sort of trying to paint a picture for your, so you could move forward in evaluating the bill. What we would likely do is to have someone attest under a penalty of law that they have only worked those 20 hours a week and that they've met the legal requirements. And then we would be beholden to investigate if a complaint were turned in that someone was actually trying to defraud the state by working more than 20 hours a week on a part-time license. So we would not, there would be no real way that we would ask for that verification, like such as, you know, records or anything along that line, but we would require that attestation under penalty of perjury and certainly investigate if we received a complaint.
So, follow up, I appreciate this dialogue, because it does seem a lot more energy on the division to have to look into this rather than just making it a clean piece. You said something in this dialogue, and I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. If someone files for an inactive license, they would not be able to carry the title of psychologist because their license, though it exists, it's inactive, and therefore they really can't carry a title because they're not a practicing licensee. Am I getting this flow correctly or am I off?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, usually an inactive license is adopted by the legislature or the board to allow someone to be able to continue to call themselves a doctor or to hold that credential, but without being able to practice that profession. So if someone were to write a book, for example, they could call themselves Dr. Kenneth McCarty, but could not see patients under that inactive license. And nursing has this, architects, engineers, and land surveyors, people who want to maintain that prestige and recognition of their hard work
without actually practicing in the field.
Let's, Representative Carr, maybe let's pause on this and go to the inactive license part of the presentation and then return these questions, if that's okay.
Okay, thank you. And as was mentioned, the inactive license, through the APA's Model Licensing Act, it notes the definition of psychologists who are suffering from health problems on military assignment outside of a state, on sabbatical, retired, or have moved to another state may wish to be on an inactive status, thus relieving the psychologist from paying full licensing fees while in inactive status, allowing them to remain in good standing without being an active practitioner. So that would be the addition of the inactive license.
And go ahead, Representative Carty, with more questions.
Thank you. Through the chair, so that defines that inactive is not just check the box of inactive. You actually have to have a reason that fits under these criteria that was mentioned to be inactive. And therefore, it appears that you cannot check the box inactive just to retain the title of psychologist. Is that correct? Whoever wants to answer that question.
Dr. Lane, would you mind answering?
My assumption is that would be worked out in regulation in terms of what they were doing. I can envision having a fairly comprehensive list. But for instance, Mr. Gwinden didn't mention family medical leave, for instance. And so I would be concerned about a comprehensive list that wasn't actually comprehensive. But I'm assuming from the point of view of this piece of legislation that those details would be worked out in regulation.
Go ahead, Representative Carty.
I
have a question, so go ahead. Is this all about paying $500? I mean, that just seems like a fairly low cost for someone with a doctoral level of education. Am I missing something?
I think the inactive license, to the committee, to the chair, I think the inactive license is really something that lots of states have, and therefore we were just trying to give Alaskan psychologists the same kinds of things that other states have. I hadn't put as much thought into the actual fees and things like that because, again, that seems to be something that the board would need to know or have an active part in terms of how many licensed people there are, the fees, and all of that kind of stuff.
Ms. Chambers, thoughts on the inactive license? Do you think this is a sort of a workable model, or what are your thoughts on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, as I mentioned, several programs have an inactive license. People want to say that they're a nurse or a psychologist or an engineer, but not practice. And I would hope my advice when we get to regulations with the board would be not to require a reason. There's not really a purpose behind requiring a reason. It would just be if someone's going to say, I'm not going to practice, that they would file the paperwork, the online verification would state they have an inactive license, they're not allowed to practice, and then they could change that. The bill allows for a method to reverse that if they want to maintain the continuing education and come back into practice. So it could be a family emergency out of the state for an extended period of time, or it could be someone at the end of their career who wants to retain that recognition again for the hard work of their career, but the bottom line would be that they would not be allowed to practice.
Representative Carty.
Through the chair, so that's a good point, and I'm thinking of a friend who's in their 80s, they're an engineer, they maintain their license going through the CEUs and such, and that's a really honorable thing. If they went inactive, and this gets into other boards, that's my understanding that people cannot use that title. They can say, I've been involved in engineering, but they can't say, I'm a licensed engineer, or they can't say, I'm a psychologist under the title there if they're inactive. Is that accurate in what's going on in the division?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, that's not my understanding. My understanding is that they can still say that they are an engineer, that they are still saying they're a psychologist. They just can't say that they're licensed to practice psychology or licensed to practice engineering. So they get the benefit of the title, but they can't hold themselves out as taking engineering jobs or seeing patients. And it really is for folks who are sort of ending at the end point of their career.
Okay. Mr. Rigondeaux, please proceed.
Okay, next slide, please. And the this is our last slide. HB 276 would also define the practices of who the practice of psychology does not apply to by adding a contractor and the definition of a tribal organization. And as the legislation reads, an officer, employee, or contractor of the United States government or a tribal organization who is licensed to practice psychology in another state and is practicing psychology while in the discharge of the officer's, employees, or contractor's official duties. So this was just the addition of adding the term contractor and defining a tribal organization.
Yeah, so I do have a question about this.
Practice does not apply to.
So these people would then not be paying fees, is that right? Director Chambers, how many psychologists work for a tribal organization who will now not be paying fees? I would guess that there's a significant number of psychologists relative to the entire workforce who actually work for tribal organizations.
Mr. Chairman, the speakers may have some additional numbers based on their research, but I think that this legislation just really clarifies what's already in federal law.
Okay.
That most types of contractors, not perhaps all contractors, but most types of contractors who hold a license in another state who are working through the Indian Health Service through a personal service contract are considered exempt. This just adds some beneficial clarity. That's my understanding of this section.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Land, do you have anything to add to that?
No, that's essentially it.
Okay. Thanks for the explanation, and please proceed.
That actually concludes the presentation of HB 276, and we appreciate your time and questions to the bill.
Well, we've worn everyone out, and there are only two people left, so I guess I'll ask Representative Shiragi and McCarty. Do you feel like you have enough information about this bill to set an amendment deadline at this time, or would you like to consider it greater length?
No, let's just set an amendment deadline.
Okay. So the amendment deadline for this bill is Sunday at 3 p.m. If members have further questions or concerns, just let me know. And thanks for sticking through on the duration. At 5:54 p.m., House Labor and Commerce is adjourned.